It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Would you join me in an attitude of prayer? A mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. We sit here this morning feeling solid and permanent, and yet a nagging voice in all of us admits and possibly celebrates the fact that life is transient. The most important things in life are simply invisible. We can't see the love that exists between all of us, but it's there. It's there in our hellos, in our asking, "How are you today?" It's there in our answers, even when we're just being polite and say, "We're fine," regardless of how we're feeling. Gathered together, there is created between and among us something greater than the sum of individual parts. This is called community, and in this case, a covenant community. Covenant means we've made a solemn compact to maintain our faith and discipline. In our case, we have no dogma, no sacred holy book, so our covenant is different. Our solemn compact is to maintain our faith in each other. This is a loving and giving faith. We give each other the benefit of the doubt because we have an abundance of doubt. The Buddhists say great faith and great doubt are the hallmarks of discernment. When we, you use, read character, we bring to that reading an abundance of faith in humankind and an abundance of doubt in the idea that any God can save us. We put our invisible faith in one another, and with that belief we promise to serve not because we will be served, but because a sacred command to serve the other and to see the other in ourselves has been given. We serve ourselves by serving others. Today we rejoice in things that seem contradictory. We expand and contract, stretching who we thought we were, admitting when we are wrong, taking back things said, asking forgiveness for acts unbecoming a friend, and existing together as less than perfect human beings, loving as best we can, living better than we could have imagined, and laughing at ourselves all the while. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen.
I'm starting the first half of my sabbatical tomorrow. Jack will be the minister for the next 3 months, then I'll be back for 3 months, and then gone again between mid-March and mid-June. With all the coming and going, it's a good time to ask, what's at the core of this place and of liberal religion? What stays here as people come and go? If you took a picture of this place once a day for 50 years and then ran all those pictures at 32 frames a second, like a movie, all you would see would be a blur, and only the building would seem to stay about the same. But you don't come here on Sundays just to see the building. That's not the attraction of a church. What makes the place worth having is invisible, but it's more important than almost all the visible parts. What's at the center of liberal religion? If it isn't the minister, and we don't have one book that we call holy, like the Bible or the Quran, then what's at the center, or is there even one? Is it just a bunch of people who can believe anything they like and expect others to respect it just because they believe it? No. That would be like a collection of narcissisms, each writing the other's blank moral checks as though it made no difference what we believe. And that's not true. It does matter. Some beliefs are awful or narrow or willfully ignorant, destructive, or just too silly. It does matter. But if it matters, why and by what authority? Remember, we got no book, and very few of you fall down on your knees to memorize everything the minister says. Okay, none of you. What must we believe? And there are things we must believe. And how can you say it in a religion that doesn't have a creed or a holy book? Now you can look outside in the hall and see the trendy little pink poster with the seven banalities on it. And if you come from a traditional church, that might look to you like the creed of this church. If you read it more closely, you see that it isn't speaking for the beliefs of anyone, that this is sort of an agreement between churches, but not individuals. In other words, these were the secular values that you came in here with, and they describe the kind of people who generally find a home here. So they'll probably look familiar. But it's not a personal belief, and it could hardly serve as a religion. So what is it? That's what I want to talk about this morning. What liberal religion, or I think any honest religion, is about, why it's a good thing for you, and for our country, and even for the world. In some ways, we're wrapped in this. It isn't a secret. In some ways, it's implied in the invocation that I use to begin every service, that it is a sacred place. It's a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass understanding. Questions more profound than answers, that is not an orthodox statement. The orthodox positions are very clear that their answers are more important than the questions. Here it's reversed. And it's also in the benediction that I use to end every service here, where I say, for those who seek God, may your God go with you. For those who embrace life, may life return your affection. For those who seek a better path, may you find that path and the courage to take it, step by step by step. That's a lot of different paths outlined there. There isn't one path, but there's one general kind of destination and goal, and that's what we're about. Honest religion's about asking the kind of questions that can inform and deepen our appreciation and acceptance, really first of ourselves. I think if we can't love ourselves, our love for others can't be trusted. And then to deepen our appreciation and acceptance of others, our love of life, and our passion to try and make a positive difference in the world around us, the world outside these walls. I mean, my God, we've got a budget of about $600,000. We need to be able to answer to ourselves and the community, what on earth is the purpose of this place? What makes it worth spending $600,000 a year on? It better be doing something more than entertaining members of a private club. You better be doing something to make the world better. That's our purpose in here. There are a lot of ways of saying this. There are a lot of ways of saying, how do you find who you need to be and what you need to do? The theologian Howard Thurman has put it in one of my favorite ways when he said, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive. Now that's lovely. Another way of putting it is a little scarier. It's told in an old Buddhist story. Some of the Buddhist stories are the scariest stories around. I love them. A young seeker reported to a local guru, "What do you want?" asked the teacher. "To know the truth," said the student. "Very risky," said the older man. Do you know what's demanded of you in this quest? Oh, yes, said the student. Oh, yes, a complete, total passion for the truth. No, said the old man, an abiding, never-ending ability to admit that you are wrong. Very risky. It's a mixture, perhaps, of a certain kind of arrogance and a certain kind of humility that's required. The arrogance comes with the willingness to say heretical things like questions more profound than answers. The arrogance comes with the willingness to ask questions you may never have asked or that maybe your family has never even asked. Very risky. And the humility comes from knowing that life is so much bigger than we are and that all of our arrogance is both unwarranted and pretty silly. There are two wonderful stories from the Hindu tradition that picture the arrogance and the humility, and I've loved them both. Part of what we're about here is borrowing from any religious, philosophical, poetic, dramatic, biographical, or any other tradition that has taken life seriously, that can help us see how to take ourselves more seriously and our responsibility to the world more seriously. They're all equally sacred if they give us wisdom to walk by. It's not the source or the book. It's the quality of the wisdom. One of these stories is a wonderful story that I had never heard. It was told to me by an Indian Hindu woman who used to attend services here. She'd always come in late and leave early. I may have told you this story months ago. And I never knew her name, and I'd see her come in late and leave early. I had no way to catch her. And one day we had a special music program, and I snuck out during the music, and I caught her leaving. And I said, "Ha!" And she introduced herself, and we talked, and I said, "Why do you sneak in late and sneak out early?" And she said, "Oh, I have a teenage son, and I have to take him to school at Barsana Dham. That's the largest Hindu temple in North America. It's south of Austin, maybe 20 minutes. It's a long drive from here." She said, "Then I must drive back here to come to church. But," she said, "I must leave early because I must pick up my son at Barsana Dham again." And I said, "Why don't you bring your son here?" She said, "No." I said, "No?" She said, "No." And I said, "That's very quick." I said, "Why no?" She said, "It's boring here." She said, "My son is bored here." She said, "He does not want to return." And I said, "What's boring?" She said, "You have no good stories here." And I thought, I am not going toe-to-toe with a Hindu on number or quality of good stories, ever. And I said, he hears excellent stories at Barsana Dham. Said he hears stories at Barsana Dham that he brings home and that we discuss at mealtimes all week. She said, "You can't touch that." And I said, "Tell me a story." She said, "I could tell you thousands." I said, "One. Tell me one story." "Very well." She said, "I will tell you the story he heard last week. We have discussed it at dinner every night. It is about Krishna." Now, Krishna, as you may know, is the Hindus' favorite god. They have all kinds of pictures of him. They have pictures of Krishna as a baby. He's blue when he's a baby. They're very colorful. And as he grows up, Krishna is a brat. So kids love him. And it's a story about Krishna as a boy in school. And the teacher looks out in the class and sees Krishna sitting there chewing. Now, they know they're not supposed to chew in class. They know that. And she said, "Krishna, what are you chewing?" He says, "Nothing." The teacher got angry and she said, "You're a liar." And she walked over to his desk and she said, "Open your mouth so I may see in." So Krishna opened his mouth, and the teacher bent down and looked in, and inside of Krishna's mouth, she saw 10,000 million galaxies. That's a nice story. You can talk about that for years. And she talked to me about how, at first, her son assumed that this is a story that entitles him to great arrogance. After all, that's a lot of galaxies. And then it's so easy, she said, for parents then to turn it into what kind of action is most true and honors the spirit of one with 10,000 million galaxies within him. If you are like the gods, your behavior needs to serve something like it. Wonderful story. You can do anything with it. So there's one just lovely Hindu story, especially for kids, I think, about the arrogance that's involved in daring to believe there's something to us that is sacred, irreducible and irreplaceable, and there is. The second story is equally good at the other end. It's one I heard from Joseph Campbell, that great scholar of mythology, and seemed to be one of his favorite too. And he was talking about Indra. Indra was the head god in Hinduism, the king of the gods, number one of the number ones, the head honk, the man. And this particular Indra had a big head and was very full of himself, and you can see why he might be. Not only did he have 10,000 million galaxies, he was the king of the gods. That's fairly big. And so a wise man took Indra aside and said to this king of all the gods that there was something he needed to show him. And Indra says, "As though there's something I haven't seen." And the man points down at the ground, and the oddest sight down there, here are tens of thousands of ants marching in formation. You don't see that very often. And Indra says, "Ants." Said, "What are ants to me?" He says, "I am king of the gods. What are those ants?" And the wise man said, "In former lives, all of them were Indras." Today, king of the gods. Tomorrow, just another ant. It brings you right down. I think the bind that we're caught in is the bind of wanting to know what to do with an almost infinite potential that can lead us in routes that still lead us toward humility, which is the only honest place for us to be. How do we do it? We don't do it perfectly, but we're not supposed to be perfect. The goal is to become more whole, more full, more alive, certainly not perfect. Now, if you've lived in Texas, because there are clues on how to do this from the world around us. There are clues from nature. Plants and animals have clues for us. If you've lived in Texas for some time, you've heard of mesquite trees, and you've probably seen some. Around here, they're usually pretty scruffy and small. Very few of them will have a diameter of even a foot. But if you drive a couple hours west, you'll find huge mesquite trees growing next to rivers with diameters of 6 or 7 feet in diameter. Amazing, huge trees. Same species of tree. Without enough nourishment, it stays small, put up by a nice river, and it grows large. Or think of the fish called koi, those carp-like fish that Asians like so much and breed specially that you find in ponds at so many Asian restaurants and some in town. One of the most amazing things about koi is that, like mesquite trees, how big they get is determined by the size of the pond that they're in. If you keep a small koi in a fishbowl, it will always stay small. If you put it in a large tank, it'll get bigger. And if you put it in a huge pond, it can grow to a foot or more in length. Same species, same fish. The size of the pond, the size and variety of the nutrients around it determine how big it can grow. Sometimes the vast potential we feel inside is too big to cope with, and we go back to our smaller sides because there's something scary about thinking that we're supposed to be growing this big or this rich or even this arrogant. And there's something scary, and we go back. And I Just a few weeks ago, I saw an example of this in real life and in real time that I hadn't expected, but that's worth sharing. It's another nice story. I was in Colorado, about 8 miles west of Aspen, in Snowmass Village. And I was there to spend a week studying with a very good British woodturner named Ray Key. As some of you know, woodturning is my hobby and my therapy and sometimes my obsession. I like to study with masters because it's like standing by a big river or swimming in a very big pond. There's so much to be absorbed from these people. These guys have been turning wood for 40 years or more. They're better at it than I'll ever dream of being. So there's a lot to learn as long as you can leave your ego at the door. I get a little better each time, though I'll probably never be much more than a fervent amateur. In this class, there were 8 of us, and we covered the spectrum. One man I'll call Bob had turned, I think, fewer than 6 pieces ever in a class that was advertised as being for intermediate to advanced students. So he really had signed up for the wrong class. So Ray, the teacher, suggested that he focus on just one form, one shape of bowl that he really liked, and work that week on perfecting that one shape. And he showed Ray some pictures and some magazines. They had bowl turning magazines all over the room, all over the workshop. And he found one, a very, very simple, very clean kind of classic form. And he said he liked that. He'd always liked that kind of bowl and very thin, and he'd wished he could turn it. So Ray worked with him on what tools and what cuts and what techniques to turn just that shape of bowl. He didn't have to use many tools for it. It's just one shape. He spent all week just turning that one shape of bowl over and over again. And he made 8 or 10 bowls that week. This man, that's more bowls than he turned in his life. And by the end of the week, 2 or 3 of those 8 or 10 were very nice bowls. So he'd focus down, never mind 1,000 million bowls that you may contain. Just focus on one bowl that you can actually learn how to do in a week. It was wonderful. Someone standing by a big river and finding the right kind of nutrients to grow just where he could grow and where he was ready to grow and to use it. Another man, I'll call Tom, very different. Tom was a little showier. Tom had spent $5,000 on his lathe. You learned that within 30 seconds. Another couple $1,000s on his tools, and then he built his own workshop because he says he's a good carpenter. You learn all these things very quickly, and you're left wondering why you've learned them so quickly. And Tom needed to be seen as being good, though the truth was he wasn't a good turner. He did very mediocre stuff. He kept exploding his bowls on the lathe. That sounds loud. It's dramatic, but it isn't so loud, but it means that you're spinning a bowl at 1,000 RPM and you cut it wrong, really wrong. And the sharp tool enters the bowl and the bowl simply explodes in a tenth of a second and the pieces are all over the room. So I was glad I was out of the way. And when he finished a bowl, it was an awkward looking thing. He didn't have an eye for form, and that's what this course was about. Ray was as blunt as any Buddhist teacher. Once when Tom called Ray over to look at a bowl he was doing to ask for suggestions, I heard Ray say, "Well, there's nothing you can do to save this form. It's a disaster." Very risky studying with masters if you can't leave your ego at the door. But Tom couldn't let go of his ego enough to open up and find a new way of looking at things. He needed a new way of seeing them. He couldn't admit that he had a heck of a lot to learn because he has a $5,000 lathe and $2,000 in tools, and he's built this workshop that's better than anyone else's. Day after day, he kept doing exactly what he had been doing at home in exactly the same way he'd been doing it at home, wanting it praised, it seemed. And it wasn't going to be praised by a teacher like Ray. And day after day, he exploded bowls and made graceless shapes. At the end of the week, we had a 3-hour class critique that was very interesting. We were each to show what we thought was our best work and our worst work. Even more, we were to paint our worst work black with blackboard paint. Now, of course, this ruined the piece, but it made it very easy to see imperfections in shape and form. When Tom's turn came, some of us were surprised with the piece that he painted black because it looked pretty good. The one he held out as his best work, from where I could see it, looked mediocre. Tom praised this best piece, but Ray said, "No, you don't have anything better than that black piece. The one he just ruined by painting it." He couldn't tell the difference, even after a week, with one of the best in the world, because he would not let go of his way of seeing things to learn a new way of seeing things. Boy, is that like religion and life. The title of the week-long woodturning workshop was Pure Form, taught by a master woodturner whose pieces are in some of the best museums, art galleries, and private collections in the world. This guy's really good. It's a treat just to see his stuff. Form is what he had an exceptional eye for. He would be bothered by a little swelling in a curve that could not have come out more than a hundredth of an inch, and that was just so obnoxious to him, he couldn't live with it. And you learn after a week or so to look more closely, to see these things, to want to see these things, because you're taught to love the idea of a perfect form, of a perfect shape, and you're taught to be responsible for helping to bring one to life. Now, that's as close to a sacred mission as you get in art or in wood turning. It's wonderful. The stories of these two men, Bob and Tom, are like the differences between the one who goes on a spiritual journey and Rip Van Winkle. The first returns transformed after his spiritual journey because he's been changed. The second one has spent the same amount of time away, Rip Van Winkle, but all he has to show for his time is a beard. And that too is a lot like life and a lot like religion, that the chances are here, the rivers, the ponds are here, and sometimes we avoid them and sometimes we seek them out. We have a duty to bring ourselves to our own kind of fullness. For some, that fullness will be more intellectual or more athletic or more assertive or more nurturing, more mystical, more artistic. We're different people and one path doesn't fit all, not in religion or politics or life. There are other duties too involving our teachers and our mentors and our leaders, social and political. This man, Ray Key from England, showed it in the wood turning class, and it's an essential role. These people are the temporary guardians of our high ideals of excellence or beauty or art, in this case, and the trust of those they serve, and they have to honor those ideals, and they have to honor those they serve and transmit the ideals to the people who are paying them, to the common people. Ray showed it in taking Bob, the beginner student, and helping him narrow down his focus into something he could master so that he could produce something beautiful at the end of the week. There were many complicated forms he couldn't have produced. Ray had a sense of what he could do. He found Bob's talent. He found his passion. He linked it with his own understanding of technique and led him toward forms that Bob could do. It was wonderful to see. Here's a teacher serving high ideals and the people who want them. When leaders take those sacred ideas and permit them to serve only themselves, if all Ray wanted to do was show off and impress us with his pieces, we would all have wanted our money back. Because then they betrayed both us and their own calling. This is the accusation that I would bring in many areas of our country. It's easy to bring it against our current administration, but also the Clinton administration. Our current administration for lying about the reasons they wanted the illegal invasion of Iraq and all the rest of the things, because those lies betray the high ideals and the trust that it's their sacred duty to uphold. They squandered our trust on their own private or corporate agendas, and they didn't have a right to do that any more than any teacher does. And you can say the same of the Clinton administration for selling out American workers to NAFTA and other administrations as far back probably as you want to go. Part of religion, part of life, part of becoming aware of this invisible and fragile kind of net that holds the world together is one of our most sacred challenges. These ideals, these trusts, these hopes are what for us make up that river, make up that large pond that can nourish life and let us grow to wholeness. And it's a sin, a crime, to divert the waters from the river or the pond only to some special interests and private interests, no matter which political party is doing it. And when ministers do this, it's an equal sin. Ministers are in charge of symbols and stories trying to drive us to become most fully human, most aware of the fact that whatever is sacred in us is equally sacred in everyone else and must be honored. So if a minister is going to say, like Pat Robertson, that we should assassinate Hugo Chavez, or like Jerry Falwell, that we should murder terrorists, blow them away in the name of the Lord, or like Reverend Hagee from San Antonio, that we need to have a nuclear attack on Iran and begin World War III, they have betrayed and violated all of the high and sacred and fragile ideals that they were trusted to serve. It's as great a violation as there is. So, my hope for you is that in coming here to this church, you can find the chance to find some of the galaxies you contain, or if not 1,000 million, at least one pretty form that can be formed. Some of the arrogance that you need to break from a vision that may be too small, or a psychological script that may be too limiting. And also that you find enough of a challenge here to keep you humble. Because vulnerability really can be more powerful than strength. An ocean is bigger than a river. But the reason the ocean is bigger than the river is because it's lower than the rivers, and that's why their water flows into it. Its humility gives it its strength. A final story to make a final point about what liberal religion and this church are about and what stays here through all the comings and goings of you and people and visitors and members and ministers and the rest comes from 25 years ago when I was in graduate school studying with other kinds of masters. One was a man named David who taught arts of the ministry and was one of the most gifted preachers I've ever known, with a sure grasp of what this religion business was about and a good sense of the dramatic. There were about 15 or 18 of us in this class from many different religions. We met on Monday afternoons, and one Monday before the seminar began, about four or five of the students were sitting around on one table whining and griping as loudly and angrily as they could about the church service at their church the day before and how horrible it was. They went on with how it was awful, how inept the preacher was, how amateurish the liturgist was, how stupidly they handled the communion, and the rest of it. And one of them finally said, "I didn't get a single thing from that service." That's when David finally spoke up from across the room where he had been eavesdropping on us. What he said was, "How hard did you try? How hard did you try? It isn't passive entertainment. It's interactive." I sometimes hear people say that life sucks or that they don't see what there is to give thanks for, and I want to say, how hard are you trying? How much are you seeing? How much of yourself are you investing into an imperfect life in an imperfect world? Because that's the other part of liberal religion. You don't get canned, prepackaged answers here. There isn't a sentence you can memorize that will save you no matter who you are, what you do, or how you behave. Doesn't exist. It's a do-it-yourself kit in an atmosphere where everyone who's trying to do it has material they get from sermons, from discussions after church, and from interacting with and around one another. It matters what we believe. You'll always hear that it matters how we live here, that life is a gift, but that we owe something in return for the gift of life. We owe the world our best efforts to bring ourselves to fullness, then to offer something back to try and make a positive difference in the world around us. That's the rent we pay for living. How close to the river have we managed to live? How big a pond have we tried swimming in? When there are things to learn, can we let go of our smaller visions, smaller selves, and admit that we need to grow? We need to go where nourishment is and stay away from people and places that offer no nourishment. And then before we can throw a fit about how unsatisfied we are with life and how miserably it has failed us, there is that question always hanging in the air. How hard did you try? Inside of us are 1,000,000,000 possibilities. There's also a clock ticking, reminding us that we move every day toward that time when we shall not move at all, and that it is our move now. And we learned these things here in this pretty big pond, this large river of people moving through life, touching each other as we pass. In all of life, there are so few places like this. That's why I wanted to remind you on this Canvas Sunday just why this marvelous church is worth supporting as generously as you can.